Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing great today, Tim. I am really excited about this interview that we have coming up because we have an old friend who's joining us, and we have a new friend now who I never thought that we would get the opportunity to speak with. But before we get into all of that, we can't let an intro go by without finding out the ultimate question, which is, how are you?
Well, thank you for asking, Lance. I'm doing great. I am excited to bring our audience this episode and really this harrowing tale that is really kind of a complicated emotional case, I guess you could say. So the guests that we have on, Jody Plouchet and Chris Duet. Chris Duet has hosted the Criminal Perspective podcast, which is on the Crawlspace Media Network. He's hosted that for years now. You should go check that out. Follow the links in the show notes. And Jody Plouchet is a survivor. He was kidnapped in March of 1984 by Jeff Doucette. And once Jeff Doucette was apprehended by police, he was flown back to Louisiana, and waiting there at the airport for Jeff was Gary Plouchet, Jody's father, who shot Jeff in the head, shot him and killed him right there at the airport while he was in police custody, and it was all televised. So it's this insane media moment, and then we have an opportunity to speak with Jody, who can reflect on it after all these years. And it's just amazing to hear the journey, the emotional journey that he's gone through since this happened and where he is today. And it's just a wild conversation.
Yeah, you mentioned that this was a complicated sort of emotional journey that Jody has gone through. But even as a listener, you have to get your head wrapped around the fact that Jody was 11 years old when he was kidnapped by Jeff and had been in Jeff's trust circle. Jeff was also friends with the family. He was Jody's karate teacher. So there was a previous history there. And Jody, being 11 years old, is kidnapped, doesn't really quite realize that he's been kidnapped because he's taken to places that he's never seen before. And as an 11-year-old, he's having fun at these places. He is being raped by this man, though. He's being raped. He's being molested by Jeff Doucette. And he's trying to work out in his 11-year-old brain how he can have fun, but he still wants this guy to stop. And Jody does mention that in the interview, that it wasn't like he hated him. He just wanted him to stop. And you got that. So you got to deal with that. And if you're listening to it, there's a lot of triggers in here. So there's a warning right off the top that there's a lot of triggering circumstances and triggering statements that Jody makes. He's come to terms with everything, and he came to terms with his father committing this act of murder. Also, to wrap your head around this vengeance, you have to wrap your head around the fact that the father took matters into his own hands, did this, and pretty much didn't do any time for it because of the circumstances. So,
right.
Totally fascinating. Totally fascinating moment in crime history and media history. And we are really fortunate to be joined by both him and Chris Duet, see what their friendship is like. And you mentioned Chris does Criminal Perspective, and that's all focused on speaking with serial killers and mass shooters and mass murderers. And he also did the alternative segment to Criminal Perspective, the survivor perspective, where people like Jody will talk about how they have been able to work their way through these incredibly traumatic moments in their lives and come out a better person on the other side.
Jody wrote a book. It's called Why Gary Why, the Jody Plouchet story. And you can get that on Amazon. And it is great. Chris Duet absolutely raves about this book. I'm excited to check it out.
So I'm really looking forward to the feedback that we get from this episode because it deals in so many of those what if scenarios. If this was your kid, if you're in this position, if your dad did this. So bring on those comments. Really looking forward to seeing how the audience reacts to it. Also, word of note, Jody had no problem doing this interview in the restaurant called Twin Peaks, which is sort of like a hooter. So there might be a little bit of Twin Peaks noise.
That's right. And you can catch up with all of Jody's work. There are links in the show notes to his social media pages, but also you can check out his website. It's jodyplache.net. That's PLAUCHE. Okay, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening. Give us 5 stars.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Are being joined now by Jody Plouche and Chris Duet. How are you two fine gentlemen today?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm wonderful, guys. Hey, Jody.
Hello. I'm doing good, too.
Jody has the biggest beer.
Okay. So for those who can't see what just happened, Jody just held up a mug of beer, looked like a healthy mug of beer. And Chris, you look like you're comfortable in your living room there. Looks like it's got a nice setting. And Jody's also sort of floating amongst the planets with the virtual background. But yeah, gentlemen, what a unique opportunity to speak with you both, because Chris was the one that connected us for this. And he also, as you know, Jody, is big in telling your story. And we heard about this, I don't even know how long ago, but it's always resonated. And I just wanted to extend a genuine thank you for coming on and taking time out of your life to join us for a few minutes today.
Well, thank you for fitting me in.
And where are you exactly? I know you're not floating over planet Earth right now.
I think I'm table 42 at Twin Peaks in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, off Segan Lane.
That is oddly specific if anybody wants to go hunt this man down.
Well, the funny thing is a character in the story that we're going to be talking about here in a minute is Mike Barnett. And every Friday, Mike Barnett comes here and has lunch. And so all the girls know him, they know me. So it's kind of neat, like, you know, here's two people in this story that, you know, or here hanging out regularly. So it's kind of cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, Jody and Chris, you two are friends. Chris, you conducted an interview with Jody a while ago on your show, Criminal Perspective. You're a fantastic podcast, Criminal Perspective. And so we thought it would be nice to have you along for this conversation as well. So Jody, so tell me about the book that you wrote. It's called Why Gary Why. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right. So the book chronicles my childhood from when I was in fifth grade and I started taking karate from a man named Jeff Doucette. And we eventually started taking karate full time. We were on the fighting team. But unbeknownst to my parents is Jeff Doucette was a pedophile and he took a liking to me. So, you know, for a year, almost a year, he had groomed the family and he had groomed me. and he started sexually abusing me in April. Well, he started touching me probably in March of 83. He moved up to performing oral sex on me in April of 83. And in May of 83, he started having sex with me. And the book also chronicles the fact that he kidnapped me in February of 1984. And I was returned March 1st. He was returned March 16th, 1984, and captured by local news camera was my dad shooting him in the head. And eventually he got probation, so he got away with it, which people on Twitter love. I go, me and Chris, every now and then, he'll text me, you know, daddy blows up on Twitter. The other day on Facebook, they had I don't even know if it was a video. It was just a picture of the story. And it had 4.1 million views and 10,000 shares. And this is a story that's 38 years old, but apparently it's gaining in popularity because if you go to TikTok and type in my dad's name, it's all over the place.
Well, I think that speaks to just how that particular violation, again, using the word resonates, how that impacts and resonates with people. I'm sure this isn't the first time that you've heard it, but in a fascinating way, everyone relates to your father. Everyone understands exactly why that happened. And before we get into that, can you take us back to when the abuse started and how you were groomed and how you were and how he tested the boundaries with you?
All right. So my first recollection of him testing the boundaries, if I had to like spin it back and kind of like review it, would have been when we were taking karate and he was telling us we need to stretch and we need to do like a split. And so he put our feet on cardboard so their feet would slide. And then you'd get to where you're doing a split. But, I mean, there's still a foot between where you and the ground is. And so he'd push us down. And then he'd be like, yo, you feel the tightness right here. And he'd reach in between our legs, you know, where you're doing a split where it would be tight. And he's like, yeah, you got to be flexible to do all your kicks. And that, to me, would be the first time he started the grooming. The first time it came into my childhood consciousness, I was driving the car and he put his hands in my lap and started kind of tickling the head of my penis. And then he quit. That maybe lasted like 2 seconds. And so that's the first time in my consciousness, I was like, oh shit. But then I felt like, okay, maybe it was an accident because I'm driving a car. He had to put his hand somewhere, you know? So in my little 10-year-old brain, I'm trying to justify that.
Right. Okay. And so at the time, you know, this guy Doucette was you thought it was he was your friend and he was a friend of the family?
Absolutely, he was a friend of the family. We didn't think he was a friend of the family. He was a friend of the family. Now, he was a terrible friend to the family, but at that point, at that time, you know, let's say the summer of 1983, yeah, everybody loved Jeff.
Jody's dad Gary literally gave Jeff one of his shirts. That's
right. Not off his back, but he actually gave him his shirt out of the closet, let him shower at the house. And he took him to my grandparents' house, my dad's parents' house, for Sunday dinner that we did every Sunday. And my dad, like, he had stayed over that Saturday night. We would always have family over on Saturday night. We'd play like, eventually resulted in like Trivial Pursuit. But I think at this time it was like Pictionary or something like that. And we would always get together. My aunt and uncle lived in the neighborhood. And we just invited him over for family night. And he stayed the night that night. And so my dad was going to drop him off. And when he dropped him off at the karate studio, we leave the karate studio parking lot. And all of a sudden, my dad just crying like a baby. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, he's pitiful. He doesn't have anybody. And he just felt bad. So he turned the car around, went, picked him up, brought him home, let him shower, gave him a shirt out of the closet, fresh shirt out of the closet that was clean, and took him to my grandparents' house. So, I mean, the video that everybody sees where the man, you know, getting justice for the man who hurt his son, my dad was also betrayed as well. And I think that factored into it because, I mean, he literally trusted this man enough to bring him to his parents' house.
And was this an overall plan that Doucette had to infiltrate your family?
It's not just a Doucette plan. That's just kind of like a pedophile plan because,
yeah,
you know, normally someone who is a trusted adult known and cared by for the family is someone who abuses children. So you got to gain that trust. Because if you just take a kid and just grab him and then start performing oral sex on him, he's going to run and tell mommy. It's the, okay, this is a friend of ours. I don't want daddy to be upset with Jeff. It's just better. It was easier for me just to keep it quiet.
And he was doing this to multiple kids in the karate studio.
Yes. he actually, I mean, there's kind of a trail. I suspect that there were a couple other boys that I took karate with, because he also stayed the night at their house. And you're not going to take a pedophile sleeping in a room with a 10-year-old boy, and he's not going to do what a pedophile is going to do. But I was his favorite at the time. Previously, there was another kid who was his favorite, but he aged out. He had gone through puberty, and so Jeff didn't want nothing to do with him. I was still 10, 11. I hadn't gone through puberty, so I was still Jeff's type.
Wow, okay. And then what happened when he kidnapped you?
He had some financial problems, and he was facing a court date. And if he didn't, you know, produce the money, I think it was like $15,000, he was going to be held responsible for writing bad checks, embezzlement. Well, I forget whatever the charges were. So instead of facing those charges, he decided to leave town, which no one was going to go looking for some dumb karate teacher who didn't pay his rent for 3 months and, you know, rip some dude off for $15,000. They're not going to go chase you around the country for that. But he decided, because I was his love interest, and he was a lonely little child boy man, he decided to take me with him. And then he went from, you know, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution to aggravated kidnapping very quickly.
Was it immediate that you knew that you were kidnapped, or was it gradual?
Oh, no. He told me, he said, if I don't get the money in a couple of weeks, then I'm going to go to California. I'm going to take you with me. And that was the closest I ever came to telling, because I really didn't want to go to California. But I also didn't want to face the wrath of what would happen if I told on Jeff. So I just kept my mouth shut. And the day he came to the house, asked my mom to borrow the car. He said we were going to go look at some carpet at this house that was being built by one of the other karate student's parents. And when we got in the car and headed the opposite way, I realized that, okay, maybe this is it. And he said, yeah, we're going to California. So we took my mother's car to his brother Mike's house, picked up some stuff, some clothes, sleeping bag. And then we drove to his mother's house in Port Arthur, Texas. And we stayed there that Sunday night and that Monday night. And we got a bus ticket to leave Tuesday at like 11 o'clock from Orange, Texas, heading to Los Angeles. And my mother and my uncle in sheriff's department, or sheriff, you know, deputies, they traveled from Baton Rouge to Port Arthur that Tuesday looking for me. And they just missed us by about an hour.
Real quick, Jody, when you say face the wrath of telling on Jeff, you mean face the wrath from Jeff, right?
Yes. I felt Jeff was very manipulative and controlling, and pedophiles do this to keep the child from telling. But I was scared that, yeah, I mean, here's this karate teacher. Here's someone who, you know, could physically harm me. And I didn't want to be the one to tell on Jeff. So yeah, that's who I was scared of the wrath.
Had you ever experienced that particular wrath from him, or seen him with another child in a state like that?
No, I've seen him go in fits of rage and guilt trip me because I rode to the grocery store with my dad on a weekend that he had me. So, yeah, I had seen, and I was pretty much understandable what he was capable of doing.
That must have been absolutely terrifying.
Well, it wasn't like that all the time. I mean, it was moments that it would be like that. Most of the time, it was fun. We'd be going to the mall or the arcades, and he'd give us money. I mean, how many kidnapped victims can say they went to Disneyland?
Yeah. I mean, it leaves you speechless. Like I am speechless because I've never heard that. And we've talked to numerous people and they've had so many stories, and it's never been the case. And it really puts like an incredible, like, human element to it. Like it makes it less like a story and more like a tragedy. You know what I mean? Like,
well, Chris, you did Criminal Perspectives. How many kidnappers were like, oh, sure, I'd bring them to Disneyland?
Yeah, it's very rare, to say the least. But yeah, Jeff was out in public with Jody after kidnapping him. They rode a Greyhound bus to LA, were staying in hotels. They were out and about, like Jody said, Disney, you know. They saw an episode of Hill Street Blues being filmed when they got there. I mean, that Jeff was not hiding Jody in a dark dungeon, you know?
Right, and that's where your head goes, and that's where it becomes almost like you can separate it, because it seems like fiction. When you say we were out and about and we went to Disney, it gets under your skin a little bit more, I think. At least it did for me right now. But
yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. And can you give a timeline on this? You were taken in February?
Taken February 19th. Jeff's mugshot is dated February 29th because 1984 was a leap year, and I was returned home like 6 in the morning on March 1st. I left out of LAX about 1:15 in the morning. I arrived in New Orleans, MSY, at like 6 a.m., 6:15 a.m.
Okay, and what happened to get Jeff, I guess, arrested or caught?
I think Jeff allowed himself to be arrested and caught because I think he had $6 in his wallet when he was arrested. But what led the cops to him directly is he allowed me to call my mom, Collect, which again, Chris, next time you talk to a kidnapper, be like, would you allow a kid to call Collect? Because it's not on the, that's not on the kidnapping checklist. That's on what not to do. But he allowed me to call home. My mother asked the operator for time and charges. And for those who might be a little younger, a Collect phone call is when you would call a long distance call and make the other person who's receiving the call pay for it. And so my mother, when the phone call was over with, the operator got back on the phone and said that call was 29 minutes and it was going to be $14 or whatever, you know, cost of the call was. And then that's when Mike Barnett, the guy that eats lunch every Friday at Twin Peaks, he got on the phone and said, look, this is I'm with the Sheriff's Department in Baton Rouge. This is an FBI investigation. I need to know exactly where that call came from. And it came from room 38 at the Samoa Motel at 425 Catella Boulevard. At the corner of Harbor and Catella, literally a block from Disneyland.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. From your parents' perspective, at this time, you were missing, and they didn't know where you were?
For a week, I was missing. They knew Jeff had me because my mother had contacted with Jeff's mom when Jeff had taken me there that Sunday. Jeff's mom was like, he's going to be back tomorrow. And then Monday I didn't return, but Jeff's mom had talked to my mother on Monday and said, they're leaving and Jeff's going to drop him off. But my mother didn't wait. So I was gone for like 10 days. I was 11 years old. I mean, it was conflicting emotions because one of the coolest things I ever saw was the Hollywood sign. I mean, I got chills just looking at the Hollywood sign. I was like, oh, that's awesome. So, you know, there was a conflict of, okay, I'm away from my family. And, you know, I didn't treat it like a little vacation, but I made the best of what I could do and tried to enjoy it.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say that must have been incredibly conflicting to be in this, you know, area where like it's not anything like home and you only see it on TV and you're so young and impressionable and you realize like you're not supposed to be there though. So you must have had some guilt enjoying yourself the best you could. But I guess that was a really successful way to cope with it. It was your coping mechanism to just like get through it. When were you able to kind of separate yourself or come to terms with the fact that it was okay to have fun while you were out there?
You know, I looked at it from the get-go that, okay, you know, I felt like it was out of my control. I didn't feel like I could bail on Jeff. So I just figured I would just, you know, go along and make the best of it. Looking back, I mean, it was cool. We're walking down the streets in Los Angeles and there's, you know, Mercedes Benz all over the place. There's Rolls Royces all over the place, which, you know, back then, Rolls Royce, you know, in Baton Rouge, that was rare. You'd see Bigfoot before you saw a Rolls Royce driving around Baton Rouge. You know, we saw 10 of them in just 30 minutes. And the fact that we got to actually watch them film a segment for Hill Street Blues, that was cool as shit. You know, so, I mean, I made the best of it. Now, that night when he got the money wired to him and he got an $85 room at the downtown Los Angeles Hilton, that wasn't a good point that I looked fondly back on. But, you know, the trip to Disney, and I even made a joke about it, because when I went to Disneyland, we went to like New Orleans World and I ordered a bowl of gumbo. And it was like, what's this shit? This isn't gumbo. This is like jambalaya-ish type stuff, but with tomatoes. And it was just nasty. And I even made a joke about that, you know, that video a few years ago about Disney gumbo that just looked like crap that everyone made fun of. And I mean, you know, I tried to make the best of it.
So at that time, you were not like necessarily angry at Jeff.
No, I wanted him to stop doing what he did. But no, I didn't hate him. I wasn't angry with him. Now, let me say this. I am now speaking as a 50-year-old looking back on an 11-year-old's perspective. At 50 years old, I think it's awesome and it couldn't happen to a better person to be viewed on YouTube and Facebook and Reddit and Twitter over and over again. It couldn't happen to a better person.
What do you mean by that? The his fate? And the fact that it keeps replaying in history?
That what he's known for is being the pedophile that got shot on live TV, which, by the way, it wasn't live. It was recorded. People may have been watching the news live when they showed it, but the shooting occurred around 9:30. The news aired at 10. But, you know, it's just the fact that people, this is terrible, and I'm not this kind of person, but the fact that people celebrate his death, again, it couldn't happen to a better person. Maybe Hitler, you know, maybe Pol Pot. Chris probably knows, has probably spoken to some people who probably deserve a better fate. Yeah, Chris probably knows a few people that deserve it, but yeah, I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I think that's important to state that you're speaking from your position now as an adult, going back to the mindset of an 11-year-old boy in that position. So there, it's two different people right there.
Oh, and I've seen like, oh, people, oh, he went 15 years without talking to his father. I'm like, and I'm commenting, I'm like, where'd you get this information? Well, it's common knowledge. I'm like, you do realize who I am. I'm like, I promise you, I talked to my father immediately. Like, I mean, I think the first night I was around him after the shooting was at his friend Budgie's house, and I didn't really have much to do with him. When he moved back in the house, I wasn't happy because my parents had been separated for 6-8 months, and, you know, daddy's coming home, and but daddy was also not supposed to drink. So it was probably, you know, the shooting happened in March, probably around July, June, July. That's when I told my dad, I said, look, I understand what you did, and I'm not mad at you anymore. And so I think that meant a lot to him. We were walking to the pool, in the neighborhood pool, we were walking down one night. And I just said, I just want you to know that I'm not angry at you. And I think that meant a lot to him. But it wasn't 15 years.
right. Okay, so your book is titled Why, Gary, Why? And so what exactly did your father do?
All right, so on the night of Friday, March 16th, 1984, he drove to the Baton Rouge Airport with a gun tucked in his boot. He got on a cell phone before you would go through the metal detectors. This is before the gates. This is more like a terminal lobby area. And he was talking to his best friend, and he said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. He had the gun, and actually Mike Burnett came walking out first because the cameraman was out there, and people had gathered behind the camera to see, ooh, is this going to be like some big celebrity? And Mike told me not too long ago, he told me, said, yeah, he goes, I walked around the corner, I saw these people gathering, and they're like thinking like some big movie star is going to be coming around the corner. And I'm thinking to myself, it's nothing but two drunk cops and a pedophile. And he said, right then is when he heard, bow. And he's the one that turned around and yelled, why, Gary, why? So his quote, it actually was why, Gary, Gary, why? But everyone remembers why, Gary, why? So that's why it's the title of my book, because of the words that Mike Burnett said, and that's the one that I see every Friday at Twin Peaks.
Yeah, okay. I it's amazing to me how you recount that story so matter-of-factly, and then button it up with, and this is a guy that I see every Friday at Twin Peaks. So where did that relationship start with him? And I guess I'm getting ahead of myself with the questions.
Well, yeah, it's a little ahead of yourself. So my dad turned and shot him. He told us for guys. So Mike, I'm gonna come back. Remember that question. Come back and ask me, because it's Mike's relationship with the family. So,
yeah,
daddy tells his friend, he is, oh, they must have taken him out the other way because I see Mike and nobody else. But Mike was checking out the area, and so Mike turns and he waves Bud Connor, that was the other sheriff who was walking next to Jeff, and he waves him forward. And so you can see in the video, you can see Jeff and Bud are talking. Bud's like, look, if you see anyone hit the deck, you know, I'll cover you up. I'll jump. And then right then, daddy turned around right when the lights got parallel with him. And he was looking through the side of his glasses. He watched the walk. Well, he lost sight. But when the lights came even, he knew to turn around. So that's why his timing's so perfect. He turns around, puts the gun in his ear, and blows his head off. But, all right, so going back to Mike Burnett's relationship, him and my dad, they weren't really close friends, but they knew each other since middle school, since junior high school. They went to high school together. Mike was a couple of years older. And before my dad and my mother ever met, my mom dated Mike for 9 months. And so whenever my mom and dad got married, she told him that daddy knew Mike. And so every time daddy was running to Mike at a bar, he would go to the payphone, call my mom and say, hey, guess who's here? And it may have happened like once every 2 years, LSU football game. I remember the first time I met Bud Connor was at an LSU football game, and I saw Mike. I went up and said hey to him, and he goes, oh, there's Bud right over there. He said, go tell Bud thank you for letting my kidnapper be killed. And so, you know, the whole thing that the police set Jeff up to do that, that's not true. There's that narrative. But the police had nothing to do with it, I can assure you. So I went up to Bud, and I said, hey, Bud. I said, I'm Jody Plosche. I just want to thank you for getting Jeff shot. And he looks at me, goes, F that. He said, let me tell you something right now. He goes, one, if I'm going to set up someone to be shot, I'm not going to be standing right next to him when it happens. And number two, it's not going to be in front of a video camera. So anyway, like if Burr would have stopped like 3 feet and let Jeff keep walking and Jeff got shot, then I'd be like, yeah, that was a setup. But what happened was my dad used to work at WBRZ Channel 2. And he bowled and he knew everybody from that TV station. I mean, they were his friends. And he was having lunch that Friday at a restaurant called the Cotton Club. And he was sitting at the bar area. And the program director, his name was Bob Shadell, he looked at my dad and said, hey, when are they bringing your boy back? Talking about Jeff. And daddy goes, oh, I think he's back already. Bob Shadell was like, no, he's not. And he goes, let me go find out. So he went and he called the news station. He said, when's Doucette arriving? They said, he'll be in at 9:08 tonight. So that's when Bob Shadell said, Gary, he'll be in at 9:08 tonight. And so that's who tipped daddy off when Jeff was coming back.
And did you say that your father had a cell phone? Did I hear that correctly?
No, he was on a payphone.
Oh, a payphone. Okay.
I thought he said cell phone too.
I may
it could have.
Have
been a slip of the tongue.
Yeah, it could have been a slip of the tongue.
I went back and double checked the year and I'm like, okay, maybe he was way ahead of the curve.
This story's amazing.
I was like, people are like, oh, if your dad would have done that now, he would go to jail. I'm like, no, he wouldn't. He drove the company car to the airport and he didn't get fired.
Okay, so Mike Barnett is the officer who says the phrase that your book is titled, and then what does he do? What does your dad respond with, and how does that play out moving forward?
You know, my one regret is I didn't publish Mike Barnett's deposition in my book because it's actually funny. Like, they go, Mr. Barnett, when did you realize that Gary Ploche had shot Mr. Doucette? And Mike goes, when I turned around and saw Gary holding the gun. So when he saw my dad, he yelled, why, Gary, why? And what the first thing he did was he went and he blocked my dad from Bud shooting my father. So Mike runs and covers daddy, and daddy put his, you know, the gun up in the air. So Mike grabbed his arm. Bud got up, grabbed his gun, walked over to my dad, put the gun to his head, said, you son of a bitch. Took the gun out of his hand and went over to Jeff and closed his eyes because he was dead.
Your father was not fired from his job, but he was arrested that night.
He was arrested at night. Mike said, you know, book him second degree murder. I'm sure Mike could have said first degree murder, but he went with second degree. No, it was attempted second degree murder because Jeff wasn't officially dead. He officially didn't die. They put him on life support. They harvested his organs and he died the next day. So his official death was March 17th. But I mean, really, it was 9:08 on Friday night. So my dad shot him on a Friday night, couldn't post bail until Monday. So my dad actually did serve jail time. He did 2 days in Paris prison.
Okay. And then he was later charged with manslaughter instead of second degree murder?
Well, he was charged with second degree murder. And then he went to a psychiatric facility for about a month. And then upon his release is when he moved back home. He wasn't indicted for like 9 months because the same grand jury that indicted Jeff for aggravated kidnapping was still seated. And so they wanted to make sure that they had a new grand jury set. So my dad wasn't even indicted until 9 months later, but they worked out a deal and his initial lawyer wouldn't take the deal. So they were, the DA's office was working out a deal where my dad would serve no jail time because they felt like they weren't going to get a conviction, at least not in Baton Rouge, not in 84, they weren't. I don't think in 2022 they would get the conviction with the evidence they had against Jeff. Yeah, he shot him on a Friday, got out on a Monday, did the time in the psychiatric ward. And after that, it was just normal. He went back to work. You know, he'd had a court hearing here and there, but everything pretty much got back to normal. And finally, after my dad had to fire that first lawyer who wouldn't take the deal, he hired another lawyer. He pled no contest to manslaughter, which the actual Doucette family was okay with. What they weren't okay with was a 7-year suspended sentence, which the judge, who was a fraternity brother of my dad, made sure he didn't go to jail.
And do you ever get people telling you that your father got off easy with this and maybe get irritated with the fact that he did this and justice wasn't like officially served in, you know, that capacity?
Rarely. And mostly it'll be like in some YouTube comment or something like that. I had a guy on Twitter the other day kind of, oh, would your dad have shot his own son he was molesting kids? I'm like, probably not. But that's not what happened. So I'm not going to answer a hypothetical, you know, because as far as I know, I'll tell you what, let me say, if he would have walked in on my brother raping one of his children, yes, my dad absolutely probably would have defended the child.
Right. And I'm sure you get a lot of the, I guess, the other side of that. Like I understand why he did that, or I would have done the same thing.
Oh, I get your dad's a hero all the time. I mean, even go look at my gumbo video where I cooked gumbo on Christmas and it was 85 degrees and miserable. But I mean, people are like, oh, that gumbo looks great. Oh, by the way, your dad's a hero.
Right. And how do you feel about it after all this time?
I guess after all this time, I'm glad daddy's actions 38 years later make people happy in a way. It gives them a sense of justice was served.
And why is it important for people to read your book and hear your story?
I, you know what? Can I defer to Chris on this one? I mean, I'm not saying this because I don't want to brag on my book. And I will, trust me, after Chris, I will definitely brag on. But Chris, honest opinion.
Since this happened, Jody grew up. He joined an organization in college, Men Against Violence. He later went on to live in Pennsylvania and become a survivor activist. He was the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency Survivor Activist of the Year in 2004, Jody?
Yes.
And so Jody, he's really good at explaining in his story, when he tells his whole story, you know, in his book, he's very good at explaining along the way behaviors and you know, giving tips on sexual assault. And, you know, if this is to happen to you, these are your options. These are things to look out for. It's just as much as an instructional guide as it is Jody's story. And believe me, there is a lot more to Jody's story. It is remarkable. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I bought the book and I read it and I literally could not put it down. I read it in about 2 hours. And I mean, it's fantastic.
Another thing I'd like to add is that I know it's a story about child rape, kidnapping, and murder. But if you go look at one of my Amazon reviews, someone said, this book is hilarious. I know that, you know, you're not expecting for me to say that, but so I tried to, and I think I did successfully, put humor in there along. So you're not just going to be like, oh, this poor kid, he was raped and dad shot the guy and this is terrible. I mean, I guess daddy gets off, so it has a happy ending.
The content is very easy to digest. And I think Jody, you know, formulated it that way. And it's funny because Jody is, I think a lot of people, I think that takes them back about the book is how honest Jody is, like unflinchingly honest. And that's just the type of person he is. But I mean, it comes through in the book and people do pick up on that. So I mean, Jody really, he bears his soul in it. And then, and there's a lot to it. I mean, in the early 90s, Jody went on the Geraldo show, and after his segment on Geraldo aired, a boy from his city reported that he was being sexually abused because he saw Jody's segment on Geraldo. So Jody has gone on to directly help people, and that's indisputable. And his book is, man, it's, I think everybody should read it.
Yeah. I took into consideration that like survivors might be triggered if I went too detailed. My mother was like, you need to put more details. I'm like, no, I don't. I said, I put enough details that you know that what I went through wasn't good. And I told her, I said, I also got to take into consideration, I don't want this to turn into like Penthouse Forum with pedophiles and they're jerking off to it. So I didn't want to put too much detail in there because I didn't want, you know, survivors to put the book down. But I also wanted to give them hope and let them know that, okay, with the proper counseling, therapy, support, depending on which one you choose, you can work through this and you can be okay. You can thrive, as they like to say in the sexual assault survivor world. You can go from victim to survivor to thriver.
And with this unflinching honesty, this this quality that you have that Chris described, and maybe Chris, you're better to answer this because for Jody, this would totally be a hypothetical. Do you think that, and I guess, Chris, in your experience speaking with people, the types of people that you speak with, is this type of quality a direct result of the experience that he had?
I think he made it about, I think the experience that he had, I think maybe Jody was like, look, if I'm going to tell my story, I'm going to tell my story, you know? And I can't say if this, you know, made him more or less honest of a person. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if Jody knows that, but I think the way that he approached his story in his book. I think it was deliberate, is the best thing that I can say. I think it was very deliberate of him, even if he's not an honest person. I think how he wrote his story was very deliberate in its honesty.
If you read it, you're probably like, you probably should have lied about that one. There's one spot that I really made sure I put it in there, because of all the books on sexual abuse that I've ever read, I've never really even seen this. But a lot of times, children, when they grow up, will internalize and they have that guilt that, okay, why did I allow this to happen? Why didn't I say anything? That's because the human body is a human body. It's going to respond like a human body. The first time we were in Houston and Jeff was like, oh, I'm going to perform oral sex on you. He didn't say it like that, but I didn't know why he wanted to do it. I didn't know that was a thing. And then my body responded and I had an orgasm. I didn't know what an orgasm was. And my toes were curled, my legs were dead. And I tell that story and I do it for a reason, because I want people to know that there's no reason in feeling guilty because your body responded like a human body responds. Now, mentally, I wasn't enjoying it. My body was responding and I was freaked out, but it was what it was. And so I wanted to point that out there. So someone who has been sexually abused, let's say, from the time they were 9 to 14, at some point your body's going to experience pleasure, and it doesn't mean that you're experiencing pleasure, your body's experiencing pleasure. So I wanted to make that point, because that's where a lot of that guilt comes from, that survivor guilt comes from.
Right. Now it's going to just tear up the survivors, because just the fact that someone did this to you, who was a friend of your family and someone that you trusted, and then your mind's thinking one thing, your body's doing something else. Kids who are 11 and 12 years old have it tough enough anyway, just trying to figure out the world. And then you have this violation. It's amazing how you came out of it, because you recognized that you needed, I don't know if you went through counseling, but you recognized you needed the support, and you got the support and you had the courage enough to write the book and put those parts in, because I think that people have to read that to know. It's really uncomfortable to read, but
it really does show how incomprehensible it is. The victims literally cannot comprehend it. That's how fucked up this abuse and everything is. And Jody gives you that from his from his story, from his recollection of events and everything. And he it comes across, and it's I think it's great that he put content like that in his book, and there's so much more. That's why it's just a unbelievable amount of value in that book. I think any parent definitely should read it.
Oh, definitely every parent should read it. I had a guy, a local news reporter, he did an interview for the local paper when my book first came out. And he said, what took you so long to write it? Because the shooting happened in 84. I published the book in 2019. And I told him, I said, like my dad that night at the airport, I knew I only had one shot to get it right. And so I wanted to make sure it was the best book it could be. And I really think, it's probably going to happen when I die. But I really think every parent and, teenage kids should read it. Even the boys should read it, because it'll put into their heads, okay, you know what? Some stupid shit dumb boys do when they're 15, 16 years old. There was a case in Pennsylvania where they would get their girlfriends naked, take pictures, and they'd put it all in a Dropbox where they all had access to it. Well, that's illegal. You can't do that. So they need to know that there are consequences to these actions, even though they weren't trying to hurt the girls. They were just being stupid 15-year-olds.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. What is your message to parents? Obviously, read the book, digest it. But what is your message?
Okay, the message is you got to be cognitive of what you say and how you act around your children. Because people ask me all the time, why didn't you tell? One of the reasons, because I knew my dad would kill him. And you hear parents say all the time, if anyone ever touches you, let me know, I'll kill that son of a bitch. Well, guess what? Odds are it's going to be a family friend, trusted adult. It's Uncle Bill, Uncle Paul. They don't want Uncle Paul shot. They just want Uncle Paul to quit. So you say things like that, you got to be careful. Other things, I had a woman tell me in Pennsylvania that she told her daughter that if anyone ever touched her, that she needs to tell on that person, because even though that doesn't kill the child, it kills their soul. I was like, what kind of trash is this? I know it sounds great to go, oh, he scarred this child for life. No, you know what you're telling that child? Oh, you're scarred for life. And so it's called the self-fulfilling prophecy. If they've told they've been scarred for life, or they've been damaged, or their soul's been murdered, then odds are they're going to fly around a pole one day making money $1 at a time.
That's an interesting perspective, because I think people just try to do the right thing and say the right thing and don't have any idea what the repercussions are when you're talking to some individual who's at the age that they're so impressionable. And if the term self-fulfilling prophecy is spot on accurate with that. I mean, what else do they have to live up to if they're told that their soul's been murdered?
And I guess the overall message is the last line in my book. It's a quote from Helen Keller, and it says, the world is full of suffering, but is also full of the overcoming of it. And I think that that's my overall message, is that, you know, okay, bad shit happens, but you can't be okay with the proper therapy, counseling, or support, unless you're murdered. Then that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like sexual abuse, that kind of thing.
Right. And did you go to therapy?
I was forced to go to therapy for court appointed reasons. Like, okay, if daddy went to trial, they needed to have a psychological evaluation on me. But I only went for a short time, and the psychologist, whichever one, it was a doctor, so psychiatrist, he told my mom, he's like, nah, he'll be fine.
And do you have a family now?
Just the ones I came in with. I don't have any children of my own, no.
Okay.
And I don't want them. I worry enough about this cat I got.
Understood. I feel like you have a secret to gumbo, too.
Don't get Jody started on cooking.
Well, the secret to gumbo is don't get too fancy with it. Just let the ingredients speak for itself. Make you a good roux. There's a debate over tomatoes or okra. If you don't like tomatoes, don't like okra, and you're satisfied eating some type of stew, that's fine. But my seafood gumbo has tomatoes and okra, and I promise you it's better than anybody else's.
His next book's going to be a cookbook, apparently, so everybody be on the lookout.
No, me and my friend, we came up with the idea like 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, to do like the Le Pan cookbook. And I actually have several dishes, but the point of the cookbook was, and I've seen them like this now, but it wasn't like that 15 years ago, is I took a picture of every step. I mean, sliced the onion. I took a picture of the onion slice, sliced the carrots. So I took a picture. So at every step, because when people go, you need to fold in the ingredients. Well, unless you took a culinary class, you probably don't know what fold in the ingredients is. So I would show you in picture form what folding was. And I've shared my recipe with white beans with several people, and they love it. So if y'all need a white bean recipe, I can send you the file.
Yeah, let's exchange information, because I'm very much on board with getting good recipes from somebody who's from Louisiana. This is like gold here, culinary gold.
I can cook mustard greens better than anybody on the planet.
Oh, need that recipe.
Where can people get your book?
Go to Amazon. Type in Why Gary Why, the Jody Plochet story, and it's available. I think the Kindle is like $9.99, and the paperback is $19.99. If you want a signed copy, that'll be $20 plus $5 shipping and handling in the United States. Just reach out to me, Twitter, Facebook, Messenger, email address. I'm as available to anybody, because, I mean, you know, everything's out there. I mean, not that many people are chasing after me, but I mean, if you're interested in a signed copy of the book, I definitely will sign it and ship it out. I keep books on me all the time. That's how I was able to have one in my truck when Shaquille O'Neal came walking in.
Of course. And aside from your cookbook, what else are you working on? Do you have any plans for a follow-up book? Or
I really enjoyed the first one a lot, and I would love to write another one, but I just don't know what I would write it about. Let's get the one going now, because I mean, shortly after it was published, COVID hit. I had speaking engagements canceled, so all that has affected the bottom line.
I'm gonna campaign now for Jody Plache at CrimeCon 2023, so everybody starts spreading it around.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I wanted to go to CrimeCon this year because it was the same time of the NFL draft, and my really good friends were friends with Derek Stingley Sr., and we knew Derek Stingley Jr. was going to be drafted pretty high. They were in Vegas for it. But I'm like, I got the NFL draft and CrimeCon, and I can't go. But I did go see Garth Brooks at Tiger Stadium, so that was pretty cool.
Oh, cool, cool. Well, nice. If you do end up going to CrimeCon next year, we're going to stick real close to you because I want to experience these stories. Like, I want to experience, because we will bump into, where's that CrimeCon next year?
It's in Orlando. Oh, it's in Orlando. Yeah. You'll be bumping into me, good fellas.
There we go. Well, this has been a pleasure. I don't want to say this in a way where it's going to come across as disingenuous, but it is very humbling to speak with someone like you who's been through so much, who's able to deal with that, and keep your composure while in the Twin Peaks restaurant is so impressive to me.
I'd be crying into my wings right now if I was Jody. I'd just like, I don't know how he does it, man, but he does it, and he does it well.
I appreciate that.